All right. Good evening. Welcome to the 16th of April meeting of the Kitsap County Planning Commission. Thank you for your participation. First item is introductions. We will begin. Let's see. We can start the introductions. We have one member to make our quorum here, so we'll be waiting for him to join. But in the meantime, on my left,
Alan Beam, Central Kitsap.
Jonathan Tudan, South Kitsap.
Online,
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
And I'm Joe Phillips from North Kitsap. This evening, Commissioners Shattuck, Smith, and Kaltenburn had notified me that they are not unable to attend tonight. And we're waiting on Commissioner Bowe to join us here. So we will pause until we make our quorum.
I'm going to forward another link to Commissioner Soler. She should be able to join us in a moment, too. So just one more minute. Okay, so we have Commissioner Bowe joining us just now.
Yes, I'm
and I
here.
Believe there we go.
All right, and we just, let's see, let me get back on. All right, and Commissioner Bowe from Central Kitsap has joined us, so we have our quorum, and with that we can start the meeting. We will go over the hybrid meeting protocols. Please silence all electronic devices during the meeting. If attending in person, please refrain from conversations with other attendees or staff during the meeting. If you wish to comment, we have four methods available. First, for those attending in person, we'll take just simple hand raise to indicate you wish to speak and at the appropriate times in the meeting. Second, virtual attendees can use the raised hand button at the bottom of the Zoom window. Your name will be called and your microphone will be unmuted. Third, call-in attendees can signal by pressing *9 on your keypad. Your last four digits of your phone number will be called and you will be connected. You may need to use dial *6 to unmute your phone. And written comments can be submitted to staff or emailed to awalston@kitsap.gov by 2 p.m. the day prior to the meeting. Please include the date of the meeting that the comments are meant for, your name, and the agenda item or subject you're addressing. For all commenters, please state your name and the general area you live in. Comments are limited to 2 minutes for public comment period and 3 minutes for public hearings. These times are adjustable by the chair when appropriate. Okay. With that, we have the adoption of the agenda. To be noted, staff has requested to add a item to the agenda, the 2023 Draft Annual Planning Commission Report, to the agenda, and there are no minutes to be approved tonight. So with that, those two changes, do I hear any objections to that?
I move that we approve the agenda as modified.
Okay.
I second.
All right. All those in favor of the agenda as proposed, please raise your hands. All right. It's unanimous. Thank you. All right. With that, we've already disposed of minutes, and we come to our first public comment period. And yeah, there you go.
Okay. All right. For the record, my name is William M. Palmer, the president of the Kitsap Alliance of Property Owners Organization. And I have a couple of comments. One, I've given staff and Amanda a copy of the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, 9-0 decision, relative to the case of a Mr. Sanchez against the city of El Dorado or county of El Dorado in California, having to do with impact fees and whether they can be assessed without at all or without compensation to the landowner. I'm asking that staff, vis-a-vis the prosecutor's office or some other legal opinion as to the impact of that decision on takings of private property by the imposition of buffers on streams and creek or wetlands. I think there is a direct tie in this decision to that, but I would like to see the staff present to the Planning Commission at the public hearing setting, which I guess starts in May, and also reiterate, it provided the commission a list of 9 questions that the Planning Commission or the staff can answer hopefully prior to the public hearing, but at least at the public hearing. I think the issues that are manifest in those nine questions are significant and need to be presented to the public as well as the Planning Commission, and certainly Kitsap Alliance property owners very interested to get a response from staff or maybe even the prosecutor's office. I'm not sure. I think it's only fair. One other comment. When we pose those questions, it's not in the same category of the 21-page dissertation that I presented to the Planning Commission in March. I think questions, when they're posed, need to be answered. They don't need to be submitted as a comment for which there's no answer. So I would petition the commission and staff to answer the questions that we posed, and everybody has a copy of them.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any other? Okay, and we have Joe Labisher.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Joe Labisher from North County. Thank you. In the critical areas ordinance update, there was a consistency and gap analysis. And one of the recommendations was to clarify long-term protection measures for wetlands and their buffers. And it seems that there was, we're talking here specifically about section 19700.750.B12. And there was a small change made that was specifically in regard to mitigation sites and their buffers and marking and legal protection thereof. But the gap analysis also led me, it appears to say that that's also a problem for other remaining wetlands and buffers. So I was hoping that the presenter tonight could address that issue. I mean, it's very common. We see it all the time. When a buffer's been reduced, it's just real easy for homeowners and residents that, you know, keep bringing in some fill to cover over some wet areas and slowly move their yard over the top of the buffer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your comment. Okay. I do not see any other commenters at this time, so I'll close this public comment period and move to our next agenda item, which will be the report for the annual Planning Commission report. Mr. Diener.
Good evening, Commissioners. My name is Scott Diener. I'm the Manager of Planning and Environmental Program Divisions for the Department of Community Development for Kitsap County. I want to go off topic just for a brief moment regarding the Sheets decision, the Supreme Court decision that was just issued on the 12th. We are having our attorneys look at that, and so it might be a little bit before we can get back with a response. We don't share our legal responses with the public directly, but we can infer those responses for the public ourselves. So just want you to know that that is on our radar.
Okay.
I'm here to talk real briefly about the Planning Commission's annual report of 2023. You all have a copy of that. It's a relatively quick read. It's basically following the same template that I think some of you have seen before. Introduces kind of what the Planning Commission is about, its enabling authority, the members, and then key actions or decisions and discussions that were taken or made in 2023. And in this instance, also talks about some training and informational presentations, which we plan on doing more of in 2024. And then you have a table in front of you that shows all of the meetings that occurred and what those meetings were about. And so it is my hope, because we're wanting to get this done quickly and before our joint meeting with the Board of County Commissioners, that you can take a vote of affirmation maybe tonight at the end of your meeting, or is it scheduled for now? You can do it now if you'd like, but if you haven't had a chance to read this, it only takes about 5 minutes, and okay. You could certainly at the end of the meeting break for that and then come back.
All right. Do any of the commissioners have any questions about the report at this time? All right. With that, do I have a motion to affirm the report by vote?
I move to affirm the report.
Okay. Do I have a second?
We've got one from Commissioner Bow. It's not showing up here, but
it's not showing. Okay. All right. With second. Okay. With that, can I see a hand of those wanting to affirm the report as presented tonight? And opposed? Okay. So that passes. Mr. Bow, Commissioner Bow, you voted in the affirmative?
He did have a hand raised, yeah.
Okay. Yes, I did.
Thank you. Okay, so that passes.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Thank you. For the next item on the agenda, our work study on the 2024 Critical Area Ordinance Update. Kathleen Bonnard?
Right. Welcome and thank you for being here for the second of two work studies for the Planning Commission on the 2024 Critical Areas Ordinance Update. I am Kathleen Barnhart, Senior Planner with Kitsap County's Department of Community Development. So last work study, we focused on the proposed changes to 19-100, our introduction chapter, 19-200 wetlands, and 19-300 fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas, along with the associated definitions and special reports. And for today's work study, we will continue on with 19-400 geologically hazardous areas, 19-500 frequently flooded areas, 19-600 critical aquifer recharge areas, and one more proposed change each in 19-700 special reports and 19-800 appendices. I will then circle back to some of the questions the Planning Commission had at our last work study. Like last time, I do welcome clarifying questions as we go, but it would be preferred to hold until we get to the end of each chapter if possible. Okay, so I'm going to move on then to 19-400, which again is our geologically hazardous areas chapter. There are not too many what I will say are substantive changes proposed here, but we are clarifying a few items. So let's go ahead and just go through those. So the first clarification was in the general clearing, grading, and vegetation removal section to add that vegetation is not to be removed from both landslide and erosion hazard areas. This was always the intent and has been the policy, but a product of some awkward wording implied otherwise. This also clarifies that to do so may require some form of replanting and support from a geologist. This is already required in part due to our stormwater rules, so this is really just more of a clarification. So the next few slides are going to address some additions to how the different hazard areas are identified or indicators. The first one is in the section that addresses erosion hazard indicators. We've added potential resources for identifying channel migration zones. So it's not a change in what the resource is, it's just adding some alternatives. Next, for the landslide hazard indicators, we're including areas of unconsolidated glacial deposits that are subject to elevated groundwater levels after long precipitation events. It increases the risk of a landslide erosion. And landslide runout areas greater than the height of the slope. So those are going to be those downslope areas that are potential risk for landslide hazards. And then lastly, for the indicators, we've added the use of wave propagation models for identifying tsunami hazard areas as part of the seismic standards. Again, it's just an example of something that can be used to help identify those areas. All right. For the section on erosion and landslide hazard development standards, there were some inadvertent wording with regard to which areas this applies. So the header to this section, as you'll see, intends that these standards apply to both erosion and landslide hazard areas. So that's really just been clarified in the text that this applies to both. And then also clarified was how and where development standards are applied, namely with regard to the setbacks for moderate and high landslide and erosion hazard areas. So to be very clear, there are not changes proposed to the buffers or setbacks, how they are measured, or the type of reporting needed. This section has just been reorganized for clarity. We've gotten a lot of comments over the last few years about how it was difficult to read. So we wanted to make sure we adjust that now. So for moderate and high erosion hazard areas, as well as moderate landslide hazard areas, that vegetated buffer is still 25 feet from the slope, plus an additional 15-foot building setback for a total of 40 feet, unless that geological assessment determines otherwise. Similarly, with high landslide hazard areas, still have a 25-foot vegetated buffer and a setback equal to the height of the slope, plus the greater of 1/3 slope height or 25 feet. That is how it is today, and that is not changing. Okay, for seismic hazard development standards, we have added in to require a geologic assessment for development proposed in moderate seismic hazard areas. This is something that is not currently stated as required, but we've found that we often end up needing to request this for safety reasons. So just as a reminder, a geologic assessment is sort of a catch-all term that we use to indicate either a simple letter from a geologist to a full geologic report and including a geotechnical report. So in some cases, this may be sufficient to have a geologic letter, but we are including that. Okay, and lastly, for the geohazards chapter, we've also better clarified when a geotechnical notice to title is required. As worded now, it is required when a geotechnical report is provided, but this clarifies that the notice to title would only apply where a geotechnical report has actually identified actions or mitigation measures, such as larger setbacks, in addition to the standard development requirements or standard setbacks. So basically, every time a geotechnical report is submitted, it should not automatically trigger a notice to title. Notation was added also that when a geologist makes a statement in their report that the slope should be regularly monitored or something similar, that is the responsibility of the landowner. Any questions on the geologically hazardous areas? Again, not many substantive changes and hopefully clarifying some of the procedures.
Commissioner okay. Murphy.
Yeah, sorry, that moved super quick. Can we go back a couple slides? All right. So it says may be requested, but you'd said that often you find it's required. So I'm wondering what the difference is between may be requested and is required, and is it some RCW threshold that gets tripped over? Or
so with regards to the moderate seismic hazard areas, is that what you're yep. requiring? What we've found is that by not having those up front as part of the application submittal, we end up having safety concerns with those. Usually it's typically because the area is susceptible to liquefaction during a seismic event. And so we want to make sure that the foundations are appropriate, that the soils have been assessed appropriately. And that's where the geologist comes in to look at those and make sure that the site is going to be built on appropriately.
So is the term moderate hazard going to qualify anywhere on the map that shows liquefaction?
The moderate seismic hazard areas are identified on the critical areas maps, yes.
Yeah, I understand, but you just mentioned that liquefaction is a part of that. They don't always, hydric soils, I guess, is how it actually reads in our GIS mapping.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to understand, both for the layman or for the applicant, when would the assessment, it says may be requested. So how do we know to get that going in the beginning of a project or have a delay when we hear about it at the end?
I see what you're saying. So no, this statement is, we can clarify that. It will be required. It should be a standard development permit application requirement for moderate seismic hazard areas.
Okay. Yeah. And just for layman's terms, the assessment could be a one-page thing, not a 40-page report, but you still have to find one and get on their calendar, a geologist.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
And I had one other question on the next slide, if we can hop forward one. You mentioned any monitoring is the responsibility of the landowner. Is there mm-hmm. a definition as to what does monitoring mean? Do I owe you a report once a year? And do I have to hire somebody mm-hmm. to do that? See where I'm going? Nobody knows what that means, probably, as a property owner.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do occasionally receive geotechnical reports that indicate that a specific setback is appropriate for the specific proposal, but that there may be some instability that warrants regular monitoring by the owner. So this is to say that the county is reviewing and approving the setbacks based on the current conditions and professional engineering recommendations, but that addressing changes in conditions is really the responsibility of the landowner, especially when we're putting together, trying to determine whether or not the geotechnical report may trigger a notice to title. That's really something that's outside of the recommendations specific to the proposal that we are conditioning for. So that's why we have added that now. Just to clarify that is the responsibility of the owner to do that monitoring. What that means is between, you know, that's the professional geotechnical engineers, you know, and the landowner's decision on what they want to monitor and how often.
Would that be in the geologist's report that regular monitoring would have yeah. some definition, like check for, you know, root exposure once a year? Like, I'm just, again, I'm trying to do this yeah. as a property owner who doesn't speak the language,
mm-hmm.
just for the recording. So will the property owner understand when they get their geological assessment that if it says there's a possibility of movement, and therefore would the rest of the assessment state the frequency recommendation?
It's going to depend on what the engineer or the geologist is putting in their report. Like I said, this is something we sometimes see in these documents. And those documents are really a product that is being provided to the landowner that they are then in turn providing to the county. So that is, again, that's between the geologist or geotech engineer and the landowner to determine what that looks like.
Okay. Thanks.
Quick question about this. Your geological hazard. If that is going to impact other properties, mm-hmm. then how does that play into this? I mean, because, you know, if it's strictly on the property owner, his or her property, mm-hmm. damage would be limited to them. But if you have a big enough hazard that could go across property lines,
Right. So they're going to be assessing for that specific proposal and whether or not it's going to affect not only the property, but neighboring properties as well. So like I mentioned, the runout areas, we talked about the downhill effects. So they would need to be looking at the potential of that being a landslide hazard that could affect the properties next door as well.
Right. And I'm questioning whether that would be then only the property owner's responsibility.
Yeah, that's going to be a conversation that we'd have to have on a very, very site-specific basis with the property owner and with the geologist and making sure that is it going to be constructed in a way that's going to mitigate that risk.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Commissioner Beam.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to clearing, grading, and vegetation removal, it says that no vegetation shall be removed. You've made very particular points in the mitigation sections and buffer sections. It says it has to be natural vegetation and they have to be maintained. This sentence could be interpreted as no blackberries. Mm-hmm. Can I remove blackberries from this area? How about scotch broom? How about all the other hazardous vegetation? This just says no vegetation shall be removed.
Yeah, and so that if you're going to be removing blackberries from a critical erosion or landslide hazard area, you should be under the support of the, like I said, the geologist or geotechnical engineer.
So it takes a geotechnical engineer to remove blackberries, sagebrush, whatever.
If it's going to be on a critical slope, and this is a stormwater requirement as well, you're not to be removing vegetation from those critical slopes without that
geotechnical. So you don't care support. What kind of vegetation it is?
It doesn't matter. If you're disturbing the ground surface, removing those roots, mowing, mechanical removal is going to disturb the soils and could trigger some of the erosion and landslide hazard risks. And that's current standard, current policy today.
Okay, and Commissioner Zoller?
On that vegetation, doesn't that sort of contradict the best practices too, and we have noxious weeds that have to be removed? I mean, when you say no vegetation, but then if people are going to be cited for having noxious weeds or plants or whatever on their properties, they have to remove those.
We do work with property owners frequently on coming up with plans to do that, those kind of things, recognizing that we do need to remove noxious weeds, but we want to make sure it's done safely. So it doesn't affect, like I said, erosion and landslide hazard areas. These are all great things. We want to remove those noxious weeds, but we want to make sure it's safe as well.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry for zooming through here. All right, so moving on, I do want to take a few minutes to address 19500, our frequently flooded areas chapter. As mentioned, there are no changes proposed in the current draft. This chapter does reference our FEMA flood zone development standards in Title 15. So our current definition of frequently flooded areas comes directly from the WAC, and the addition of the last sentence about floodplains generally being mapped by FEMA, that was our addition. But note that the definition from the WAC does not specify that these are only to be FEMA mapped flood zones. And even our own added sentence is applied again generally. So we could expand this definition as noted in both the frequently flooded areas memo provided by our consultant and the best available science review. But until mapping is available, we would not be able to develop or enforce any subsequent development standards. Currently, we reference, again, those FEMA maps and require development to meet the FEMA flood hazard development standards. It was noted during our review with the working group and iterative review with our consultant, again, that there are resources such as LIDAR mapping combined with others such as historical imagery to better map areas outside those FEMA flood zones that are still susceptible to localized flooding. However, since this would be a fairly involved analysis, and again, that's not required by GMA to develop new information through this process, we have not proposed inclusion of any changes at this time. There's also not direct guidance on how and who would be able to field truth these mapped areas and what standards to implement. So again, we would need to essentially develop a new process to implement any new mapping as well. So that hasn't been proposed at this time. Any questions?
FEMA maps are subject to change. I mean, a map that's drawn in the 1980s is different than the map that you can see today.
Mm-hmm.
How do you incorporate changes to the FEMA mapping?
Yeah, so that's it's all adopted by reference. And so it's as amended, that kind of language that's in Title 19. And then again, that gets updated through our Title 15 update process when we update those. So moving on then, similarly for our critical aquifer recharge areas, when no changes are proposed. A topic of discussion during our working groups was with regards to saltwater intrusion concerns and wells. So just a little bit about that. Kitsap Public Health was part of the working group and helped to clarify their existing process for well monitoring, which does include testing for conductivity, an indicator of saltwater. While some jurisdictions' CAOs do talk about wells and saltwater intrusion in this chapter, it's because their local health departments may use their CAOs to direct that monitoring. So Kitsap Public Health has existing requirements in place to address this concern. Kitsap DCD also does not review for new wells. These can and very often are drilled prior to a development permit application that we would see. So it really is strictly a Kitsap Public Health matter. Additionally, other jurisdictions may have already identified specific areas where saltwater intrusion is a known concern, and they can focus their additional requirements in those areas. So we're not, again, at this time recommending any additional requirements or tests to monitor saltwater intrusion through the CAO. And just as a note, yes, our current maps of aquifer recharge areas were reviewed for consistency with latest information from health department and others. All right, in 19700 special reports, the only change was proposed to geological assessments, and this was to include a site plan showing the top or toe slope location and any buffer or setback, so it is clear for the reviewer that the applicant site plan is showing the correct locations as intended by the geologist. So this is very similar to the addition we added for the wetland reports, as you might recall, whether providing a dated site plan that's saying, yes, I have reviewed it and it's consistent with my findings, or providing their own site plan in their report. So we want to make sure we get that.
Do you want to ask for the top and toe of slope, not top or toe of slope? That's two different things.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
You have a top of slope, you're at site plan depicting the top of slope or toe of slope. Those are two different things. You want to maybe ask for both?
It just depends on the landscape. So in some sites, you're only going to have a top of slope that's going to be an issue. There, you know, the toe slope may be a quarter mile down the hill, right? So it really is an or situation. And in some cases, you might see both on a larger parcel, but that is why it says or. Yeah. All right, and finally in 19800 appendices, we've elected to remove Appendix A, which was the Washington State Rating System categories, wetland rating system categories. You may recall during our discussion on the wetlands chapter that we have proposed removing any specific scores or definitions, but rather reference the source document directly in the event that the state makes changes to their rating system. So that's that. Are there any questions about this or the rest of the chapters presented today before I move on? Okay.
I think we're good.
All right. I will then circle back to address some of the questions that the Planning Commission had during the last work study. So one of the follow-up questions we had was, aside from the changes in state law, what changes from 2017 have proven inadequate? What problem are we trying to solve? Have local studies been done? So the best available science considered during the 2017 CAO update is relied upon here as the foundation for the CAO, but new information is also considered obviously during this update. So science is not static. It is our responsibility to periodically review the scientific information and update the CAO. So this new information adds to the understanding of natural systems and therefore results in regulatory adjustments to better carry out the GMA mandate to protect the functions and values of critical areas. Those changes are outlined in the best available science review document that you have seen as on our website, and does include studies up through 2023 publication dates. So there is new information in there. We are also not directed by state law to demonstrate that our current buffers are inadequate or to provide hyper-localized studies or additional analysis. Rather, we are to review the current best available science and revise our CAO as necessary to that follow that information that is available. Another question we got was, what consideration did the county have of property rights and what are the legal consequences due to impacts to property owners? So as you're aware, property rights are one of the 15 Growth Management Act goals, and they have been carefully considered through this update. The county has considered property rights while understanding that we need to incorporate best available science. The CAO draft has been reviewed by staff and the Kitsap County Prosecutor's Attorney's Office following the 2018 Attorney General's Advisory Memorandum and recommended process for evaluating proposed regulatory or administrative actions to avoid unconstitutional takings of private property, as well as recent case law. The CAO has been demonstrated to not result in a taking or violation of substantive due process. Property rights advocates were invited to our working group meetings, but some did not attend. Those that did attend voiced concerns about potential impacts. Through working group meetings, community consultations, and other engagement, the county has discussed and understands the local impact of changes to the CAO. The decision to not recommend the use of the site potential tree height mapping tool and instead go with a more predictive model was partially due to the difficulties for applicants in its use, as well as the difficulties in implementation, which could add time, cost, and confusion for a property owner. Another decision was to not recommend aligning the type N streams directly with those site potential tree height values. Also, in part, due to the impact it would have on available land and property owners. So using the full recommendation from DFW on type N stream buffers would generally end up being larger. So the county has made efforts through this update to minimize impacts to property owners while still meeting our requirement to also protect critical area functions. Right. We also had a question about how we can better inform property owners and how we might mitigate impacts to them. One suggestion was a mailing. So mailing was not scoped in our outreach plan or budgeted. We followed our board approved public outreach plan, which is our typical outreach process, including regular noticing, presentations to the community advisory councils, virtual open houses, the use of social media, etc. So it is true that changes to development regulations can come as a surprise to some that are affected. This is the case with any code update. DCD understands that property owners will be impacted by the environmental regulation. We actually just sent out an additional notification last night regarding the current comment period and are scheduling future open house opportunities as well. So adding to our previously approved outreach plan. One suggestion we heard was to have the county provide special reports when they're required. So staff cannot provide required special environmental reports or cover those costs. For one, the resources to do so are just simply not available. And if they were, permit fees could potentially be much higher. And secondly, there should be a firewall really between the reports and the applicant, from the reports that the applicant provides and the staff that reviews them. And so if you remove that firewall, there could be a conflict of interest. Some relief valves, again, are available to property owners, such as the non-conforming provisions that we have in code, as well as reasonable use and variance procedures when other alternative isn't available. Staff also tried to provide clear information to inform applicants how they can develop their property and avoid requesting a variance. We have our front counter, live chat, staff consultation options. And as I mentioned previously, there's incentive programs such as transfer development rights and open space, which can reduce taxation. In addition, we're proposing updates to our zoning and development regulations through this current comprehensive plan process to allow for greater densities and relax lot size requirements, which should help develop outside those critical areas within the EGAs more. So this was a great question we got last time as well. If the alternative UGA buffer width is good enough for the UGA, then why not for rural areas? So I'm going to try to explain this. Hopefully it's clear. So county staff was asked to explore options specifically for the urban areas to help meet GMA goals with regards to reducing sprawl and increasing affordable housing. The alternative UGA buffer allowance recognizes that some buffers in the UGAs have already been compromised and makes provisions for certain redevelopment and infill to occur when specific criteria are met. So it does not apply to undeveloped land. In conversations with WDFW and others, they've indicated that the county should protect full riparian function where it exists and restore where possible. However, it is recognized that this is not possible everywhere, such as in the Silverdale Regional Center, for example, and that some previously disturbed areas may not be able to achieve full riparian function. So as such, those areas would not realize the benefits of any increased buffer widths due to their surrounding environment. This would not be the case in rural areas where habitat connectivity and chances of restoration are much greater. And with the alternative UGA buffer width, we can encourage redevelopment to occur while also requiring improvement of riparian function. So in rural areas, you're not going to see, nor are we trying to encourage infill or multifamily development, since the state guidance is that riparian areas, the buffers are fully vegetated. If we encountered the conditions outlined in the alternative UGA buffer code section, if we encounter those in a rural zone, they would be required to enhance or enlarge buffers to meet no net loss. So again, we're trying to recognize and balance the GMA goals by adding this provision. If we were to elect to decide that buffers need to be consistent regardless of an urban or rural zone, we would need to revert back to the full buffer widths, not the other way around. So it kind of have to go one way or not at all. Another point to consider is that these buffer widths will primarily impact those rural owners with non-conforming lot sizes. So while this alternative buffer width would not be available to them, they may still be able to use non-conforming provisions or the variance if avoidance is not possible. Okay. Another question, how is no net loss evaluated? There needs to be better reporting and definition of functions, other metrics, et cetera. So there are many terms used in GMA that are not defined in the Act or regulations, and some are not easily reduced to a specific as opposed to general definition. So Kitsap County has determined that terms like no net loss are really better understood in reference to the scientific literature about the specific critical area. That said, we do have a definition for no net loss in our Shoreline Master Program that we could draw from if that is recommended. With the understanding that, again, it would be more generalized. Other jurisdictions have some similar generalized definitions that we could draw from as well, as an example. Kitsap County, rather, has focused on effectiveness. The CAO update specifies reporting requirements and covenants for mitigation areas. The county is looking at process improvements for its monitoring, including follow-up on review of reports and mitigation success. When staff are reviewing a wetland or habitat management plan, we're looking to see that it has met those reporting requirements in 19700. That chapter details the type of information and metrics needed on existing and proposed conditions, functions, and values at the site and watershed scales. So we're really looking for balances in those functions, such as water quality, habitat, food chains, flood and erosion reduction, and even historic educational and recreational values. So those are the kind of things we're looking at. And again, that's something to consider about a no net loss generalized definition as we move forward. All right, the type O stream clarification. There were a few questions on that, so I do want to address that. There were also some questions posed about how the buffer would be measured on a type O stream. So you'll recall these are those systems typically in an upper watershed that may go subterranean before surfacing again downstream, right? So to clarify, the subterranean portion would not be identified as the type O. We aren't looking to require buffers for those areas. This would only apply to that stream portion that is on the surface upstream of that subterranean portion. So I apologize for that confusion at the last meeting. And we can certainly look at adding clarifying language to make sure that's very clear. But yeah, no buffers on unmappable underground surface, flows. So in addition, there was the question about whether this type O was consistent with other state definitions. So there are several jurisdictions who have actually already adopted a similar type O stream category, including, I believe, Pierce and King counties. So the DNR stream type system is not required to be used for CAOs, but it is an existing option and one that most jurisdictions have used in recent history. Therefore, it's well within the WAC guidelines to implement additional criteria for identifying fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas. Remember, this chapter is not strictly about streams either. The protections extend to other priority habitats and species, including those of local concern. So an example was that during the last CAO update, we added that other modeled or field verified stream type maps should also be used. So in accordance with that, we updated our stream maps to include some other modeled streams that were outside of just what was provided by DNR typing system. So this is very similar along those same lines. I would also like to mention that based on some feedback we've received so far and some additional consideration with our consultants, we are open to changes to the buffer width on the type O streams as currently proposed. Since by their nature, they do infiltrate as they go downstream, those water quality filtration functions are being provided, and it could be supportable to reduce the buffer to 50 feet, for example. So I do want to throw that out there. So really quick again on our schedule, we're still in the initial public comment period until April 26th, so we have 10 more days. And again, we did send out additional public notice last night as well. Your hearing is tentatively scheduled for May 21st, and we will prepare a comment matrix in advance of deliberations tentatively scheduled for, again, May 28th and June 4th. Those findings and findings of fact are tentatively scheduled for June 18th. And then over early summer months, staff will make any revisions per the Planning Commission's recommendation in public comment. Later in summer, we'll have a revised draft or a summary of changes. We'll go out for additional public comment prior to the Board of County Commissioners hearing in late August, with adoption process through September. With that, I would just like to ask if there's anything the Planning Commission would like to revisit from the first work study. I can pull up slides if anyone needs a refresher on anything we discussed. Otherwise, I can take any additional questions with me and provide responses at deliberation if necessary.
Okay, do we have any further questions? Commissioner Beam.
How does a person coming into this area know where the wildlife type class one and the wildlife class two areas are and what species are provided? How do you find that information out?
So there are both the state and federal listed species are identified for class one. So those are listed on the state and federal websites.
I'm talking about, I've got a person that wants to buy a piece of property. Mm-hmm. How does he know what class wildlife is in there?
Mm-hmm. Department of Fish and Wildlife also has an online mapping tool, the priority habitats and species, which it we do reference.
It says this is available to the county.
It's available to anyone in the public. It's online and our code does reference it.
And what precisely are the wildlife in that category that are degraded that require doubling buffers?
It's going to be on a site-specific basis. There are different species that have been identified.
Well, you doubled all the buffers in the county. There has to be some sort of wildlife that we're trying to protect.
Those are the state and federally listed species.
Yeah. The only one that's listed as a terrestrial animal on the state list is a western pond turtle. And there aren't any in the county, and there haven't been for 100 years. What are we protecting, and why are we doubling all our buffers? The other thing is, you say you have a monitoring program, but the monitoring program consists of the landowners monitoring it. Who in the county goes and looks at the performance of this ordinance and says, we need to change something? Who's responsible for doing county level monitoring to say this program works?
We would be reviewing the monitoring reports from the habitat biologist that the applicant has hired to do their report to begin with. And we would maybe ensuring that they are meeting what the standards that they set up for to begin with.
That's very nice for that site. Who's looking at the big program? How are we monitoring it? How do we measure effectiveness? How do we justify to the public we need to double all the buffers?
Again, the buffer widths are based on our current review of best available science. So that, again, we're not required to determine how our buffers are not effective.
So we just go every time we come through this, so we double the buffer again. The buffer when I bought my house was at 50 feet. It's now at 100 and you're taking it to 2. That takes the next door neighbor and the next door neighbor's property off the list. How do we justify to my next door neighbor that he's just had his entire property restricted? We don't monitor. We don't measure anything. We just double everything every time we go into a revision. End of statement.
Mr. Poff.
I don't have much to add to that, but I, like Kathleen said, we aren't necessarily required to do these hyperlocal studies or to monitor our current regulations in that way, as you've described. But I think like we tried to speak to at the beginning of this was that science changes over time. And there's a lot of scientific research that that we're going into these recommendations that establish what riparian functions are provided by these buffers. And there's numerous riparian functions that are provided by these buffers. So, you know, the idea would be that their current buffers as they exist would provide a lot of those riparian functions, but it's likely that they would not provide all of those riparian functions. And so our requirement is to review that and then say, in order to protect those functions and values, which is our GMA requirement, these are the buffer widths that would be likely to do so.
Okay. Any other questions, statements at this time? No? Okay. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
And let's see. All right. That includes that work study. And we have our second general public comment period. Do I have any people wishing to speak?
After 54 years of doing this and spending, my name is Richard A. Brown. After 54 years of doing this, going on 55 years and spending hundreds and hundreds of hours in planning sessions, volunteering for the comp plan updates, this is about the worst crap I've ever heard. Now you plan on taking farmers' land because they have a drainage ditch through their property or a small stream that might have had a fish in it 20 years ago. I'm totally against this. This is a taking, and it's nothing else but a taking. And if the Planning Commission votes into this, just think about what happens to you and your neighbors. It happens to me. It takes 400 feet of my property on one side and 200 feet on the other. Just think about that. That doesn't include the thousands of dollars I spent giving roads in my subdivisions to the county, providing storm drainage, on and on and on, the same the rest of the developers in its community. But it's got to the point that staff and the county commissioners only give care what the state wants. They don't care what the public wants. Everybody's being paid by us, the taxpayers, not the state of Washington. The only reason these guys are involved in and doing what the state wants is to get more grant money. And yet you go to get a building permit, it's five times more than it used to be. This has gone too far. The CAO ordinance needs to be stopped in its tracks.
All right, thank you. Mr. Palmer.
William M. Palmer, CAPO president. Unlike Dick, I've only been at this public hearing and public meeting game for just about 47 years. And I haven't missed a single year in all that time when I failed to participate in ordinance development, comprehensive plans, special meetings, all of that kind of thing. One thing that I would emphasize, and I will provide the Planning Commission something that I wrote to the Board of County Commissioners relative to comprehensive plan, has to do with the permit system. Aside from my number one criticism of the permitting system in Kitsap County is that it's not fair. It takes four times longer than it should. And it costs the property owner or the developer exorbitant sums of money. I detailed that in my 21-page report. You're going to be cutting out a whole lot of people from being able to either own or rent in Kitsap County. We're already seeing some people coming from Seattle skipping over to Mason County because they can't deal with the cost of housing here. The permit system is a huge bottleneck. And one of the things that causes that bottleneck is the critical areas ordinance. If you have a buffer on your land, like Mr. Beam talked about, and they can't preclude you from development, but they can make you go through a public hearing process. Like the neighbor, if he hasn't developed his property already, he would have either a reasonable use exception claim to make, send him through a public hearing. It's going to cost him thousands of dollars to go that route. So, yeah, he's not precluded, but he bears a huge cost. And we're talking about something that's supposedly a public benefit, and the public's not paying for it. I think they should. I think the Supreme Court decision that came out just the other day, but it's a decision rendered in March, that reinforces the fact that the public needs to pay for the benefit they're gaining. And I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay, thank you. Online, I have Doug Heyman.
Thank you, commissioners. Just wanted to bring up three quick points as best I can in the time. And in regards to affordability of housing, developers building large $700,000, $800,000 homes, that's not the kind of thing that's affordable for most people. And the general public knows that. Working on development in the missing middle and the urban growth areas, whatever enhancements we can do for encouraging that is going to meet those affordability standards. I wanted to express my concern around proximity of mining operations to critical area recharge areas, and would like to throw that into the mix for consideration for the critical area ordinance updates. And then in terms of the buffers increasing for the streams, the science behind that is shading of the streams to keep the temperature down. When the water temperature is too high, it's not viable for salmon. And wood recruitment in the streams also slows the stream flow rate to make it so that those young fish are able to swim upstream or downstream as they need and not just get washed away. And then the buffer increases also keep pollution out. So these aren't just randomly chosen by county staff. It's based on science. And there's good reasons for each of these, from having taken part in the working groups for the fish and wildlife conservation areas. These aren't just randomly chosen to make things miserable for property owners. They're based on true science for protecting the critical areas and the creatures and ecosystems. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Joe Lipser.
Again, this is Joe Lubisher from North Kitsap. I'd like to address Ms. Barnhart's response about the non-definition of terms. I don't think that explanation is supportable. So the full terminology there was no net loss of ecological functions. And what I've read in some of the decisions is in these wetland mitigation reports amounts to nothing more than hand waving. And when you sit down and actually look at what ecological functions are, and I'll grant you that these, you know, the analysis has got to be site specific. You know, you run into not just habitat, not just water quality, but also water quantity issues and infiltration issues. And to be honest, some of this is outside the area of expertise of a wetland specialist. So I think it is much more reasonable that we take a look at what this term means and how you're going to operationalize no net loss for these different sites. I don't think that what's being presented is really adequate. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Marla Powers.
Hi, thank you. Name's Marla Powers. I'm the staff for the Port Gamble Skalum Tribe. And I just had a couple comments. I'm a little disappointed to hear Commissioner Bean talk about what endangered species are we trying to protect. The draft environmental statement that the Planning Commission forwarded to the Board of County Commissioners for approval included a list in the DEIS, page 3-71 to 3-73, and a list of priority species on page 3-76. Sorry, 3-74 to 3-76. That's six pages of endangered species, priority species, and important habitat that are identified in the environmental impact for the comprehensive plan update, and that was referenced in the critical area ordinance, CEPA checklist, that needs to be protected by the county, and some of these codes go towards doing that. So I just wanted to point that out to you, that we have pages and pages of species and habitat that need to be protected. Also, responding to the justification of doubling the buffers, this is a simple addition of 50 feet for each type of buffer, and it's not going to be enough protection. Number one, because buffers are not protected when a property owner wants to develop. They have administrative buffer reductions between 25 to 50% of a buffer. So if you have your 100-foot buffer and you take 50% of it, you're right back to where you started. You can do a variance. I've seen recent examples of variances in critical area buffers of up to 83% of the buffer. There is no protection for critical areas in the county. And as Doug mentioned earlier in his public comment, water temperature is a new pollution criteria for streams and water because it is a basic salmon habitat. The water gets too hot, they can't survive, they can't spawn, it is no longer a living habitat. So I just wanted to do a quick response to those two topics. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Beth Nichols.
Good evening, commissioners. I'm Beth Nichols from North Kitsap. And I just want to say I strongly support the CAOs and ask that they actually be strengthened even further. They do not go far enough. It's really concerning to hear Commissioner Beam attacking the best available science. And I would really urge you to look more deeply at what the science is regarding buffers. Buffers protect critical areas, wetlands, streams, riparian areas, to ensure a functioning ecosystem that we all depend on. We have a biodiversity crisis that is documented, and there are many creatures in the web of the ecosystem that are being that are dying, and it's really the canary in the coal mine that what we depend on in our environment is going to affect us as humans and our way of life. Many citizens want to have protection of these natural resources and areas. There are many other people who want private property rights above all, but we really do have to balance these competing issues. Wetlands and riparian zones provide functions and values to all of us for flood control, water quality, and protection of species for, once again, that environmental web of life that we all depend on. So I just really ask that we do follow the best available science in these critical areas ordinances. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And I don't see any other people wishing to comment, so I'll close this period. And we have for the good of the order or commissioner comments. Does anyone have anything for the good of the order? That? Okay. I would remind the commissioners, we have a joint meeting with the Board of Commissioners on February 6th at 3:45.
May.
I'm sorry. April.
April which?
May.
You should have liked that. It would be next year. Anyway, April.
May.
May. Okay.
One more time. What?
I'm challenged today on the date, May 6th at 3:45. And you can attend via Zoom.
3:45.
Just as a note, once we get the commissioner's office will forward us links and things. So if you know already that you want to attend virtually, if you let me know that, I can let them know ahead of time and they can kind of put that in motion. Otherwise, you can always attend using the public link too. But you could also attend in person.
Now, will that be in the chamber or in the...
It's typically in Port Blakely.
Okay. Okay. Well, if I don't hear any objections, I will declare this meeting closed and we will see you back on May 7th. All right. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah.